Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.
Coach Starja, you will have a piece that will run on InsideLacrosse.com on Saturday morning, tomorrow, about a recent visit with legendary Maryland head coach Dick Adell. You went up and had an opportunity to spend a game day with him and recounted what that experience was like. I'm curious as to, you know, kind of what didn't make it into the article, a little bit of the cutting room floor. Certainly we read all about the hustle and bustle that fills the Adell household. But what was it like to be around one of your colleagues and taking a day of lacrosse?
Yeah, well, Terry, I'm glad to be here. And, you know, I've had an opportunity to visit with Dick a number of times over the last couple of years, and I would do it much more often if he was a little bit closer and it was a little bit easier to manage. You know, I always walk away feeling better for having spent the time with him. You know, and for me, you know, when I get there, a lot of the visits have been with all these icons of the game, you know, Bob Scott and Bill Tanton and, you know, all these different folks and all Jim Adams. And it's just so much fun for me to just sit there and listen to these people talk about the game. More recently, it's sort of just been me and a buddy, Jeff Wagner, and a lot of Dick's family around. And, you know, he's just, you know, his spirit is so powerful. And he's just so much great. He's so great to be with. You know, he's, you know, his body has betrayed him a little bit, obviously. But he is on top of things in every other way. He knows things about my family and my teams that I didn't know. So we can talk lacrosse, and I can give him grief about, you know, whether it's Virginia Maryland games. We had a Maryland Brown game 1 year, and that was a big and important game in the playoffs. And so we were both telling stories about all of that. And so, you know, in my very unique circumstance of what's happened to me in the last 6 months of my life, you know, I've been blessed because of that to have a lot of people that I really know and like, and like me, reach out and Dick, and spending time with Dick is one of those things that just lifts your spirit and you know, and offers you a little perspective on things and all. And so you know, I don't walk around feeling bitter, you know, I'm certainly better off, you know, for having spent the time with Dick Adell. And it's fun to sit and watch games, because he'll give people grief about stuff, and it's really just neat to be a part of his day.
It's a special experience whenever I have an opportunity to visit with him. And, you know, he's a special man. And I think one of the things that resonates with me so closely is just his ability to, you know, recall so much detail about things that happened a week ago or things that happened 25 years ago and contextualize them. And for someone in my position who wasn't around the game that long ago, it helps to understand what's going on right now a lot more acutely. But for those that follow Inside Lacrosse, they saw you appear earlier in the week to help publicize another passion that you're currently involved with, that being Harlem Lacrosse, its continued expansion and its need to staff up accordingly. So you have increased your commitment with the organization over the last several months, and now as the organization expands to Los Angeles and other markets throughout the United States, I'm curious as to your perspective on how it fits in to the global perspective, as it were.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had a very unique opportunity again. Harlem hired their first CEO, just came on board this past January, Mike Levin, the old Brown goalie, and the organization needed somebody kind of hands-on, full-time, as much as possible. So back in the late summer, early fall, the powers to be there with Harlem, I said, look, I know we're about to make this decision about hiring someone and changing some things at the top. I said, if I can, I have the time to be able to get involved here a little bit more, if I can do some things that will keep us from having to rush into a decision, if I can fill in some gaps, then take advantage of it. And Simon Cataldo, who founded the Harlem Lacrosse, said to me, Tom, he said, I was hoping you would ask. And so I've had the very good fortune over the past few months. I visited all the sites. You know, we have, you know, half a dozen programs in New York. We have two in Boston. We have two about to be four in Baltimore. We'll have two in Philly coming up. We've got a bunch going out in LA, and I've been to every one of the sites for an extended visit. And so I've had a chance to, you know, get into the center of these cities and get into a school day with the program directors at each of these schools. You know, I've helped, you know, I've been at a practice from which each one of these different programs, and it's been eye-opening for me in so many different ways. And I think it also, you know, if I've been able to offer a little bit of help to these young program directors that are in charge of these, each of these schools, I've been more than happy to do that. You know, and there's just a lot of exciting stuff going on. The expansion, you know, there's a debate in the organization, like a lot of young groups have, which is that do you sort of continue to grow sideways, or do you strengthen the assets that you have? And so we're talking about that issue all the time, because as the word about Harlem Lacrosse and the success that we've had in the schools that we're in has continued to spread, we've just heard from lots of different folks about the possibility of going to different cities and adding more programs in the cities that we're in right now. I've had an extended conversation. Actually, I'm scheduled to fly out to Milwaukee. I talked to Joe Ample about this. He's actually the president of Marquette, has been involved with, has talked to Joe about, you know, we want to bring this to Milwaukee. And so I'm going to fly out actually in May and meet with their board, even though the Harlem folks are a little hesitant about, again, about growing too fast. We want to be able to manage properly, you know, all the programs that we have in place. But for me to be able to go out and give them some information about what we're doing and what's required here, I'm more than happy to do that at the same time. So, you know, for someone like me, it started out New York City, Harlem. My father was a New York City cop. I was born in the city. Harlem was always a magical place. It checked a lot of boxes for me. And now to actually see what's going on and to see that we've actually made a difference in these young people's lives has been very fulfilling. And so it's one of the really nice things that our sport does. You know, the influence that we've had, you know, and, you know, to be able to help people that are less fortunate than we are. And I go around now talking to these, you know, typical, our regular prep school programs and teams. And one of my messages is, hey, pay it forward. That's the first one, as always. You are the chosen ones. I talked to the French school kids. They were here in town last week. I was out of Missouri Country Day last week. And it's always the first thing I'm saying is that you don't understand fully, you know, the magnitude of help that you can provide to people, and playing lacrosse, playing at a place like Friends, or growing up in playing in Baltimore or Long Island, you have a lot of gifts there, and in turn, it comes with a responsibility to try to help some others, and Harlem lacrosse is one of the ways that we're actually doing it.
A New York City native with an Ivy League education and a lifelong lacrosse coach, clearly your skill set meshes well with the needs of this organization. But what I'm curious about is, more acutely, when you leave, do you have a sense of what the largest impact of your presence was and how the day or two that you spent there manifests itself once you've moved on to the next?
Part of it is, and I'm reluctant to go there, but part of this is, you know, these kids, I mean, and I've told the Harlem folks, I said, take advantage of me while I still have some influence, I said, because it's only going to diminish unless I get back into coaching. But when I get to these schools and meet these kids, you know, they've watched some lacrosse on television, they've seen me doing things. And so there's the ability to establish some role models for these inner city kids. And then to be able to see that I'm a real person and to feel like, you know, they're important enough that I'm willing to come and spend some real time with them. And so it helps validate the process, you know. So I'm reluctant to set myself up as some kind of lacrosse hero here. But in this little world where we're trying to make contact with people and get them to buy into using the game to improve their lives, in my case, too, I'm somebody that you know, I'm from New York City. I can talk in those terms. I never played lacrosse before I got to college, you know, so for some of these young people that feel like, oh, I'm late to the game, I can't really pick it up, I'm always saying, in the category of anything is possible and you never know, I stand before you, you know, and so put some time into this, work at it, and this game can be your friend for a long time. The really neat thing, Terry, is that we don't think of lacrosse in the inner cities. And when they first started, I would say to these young people, why lacrosse? Why is it that lacrosse is making this connection in your life? And the truth of it is that when you give a kid a stick and give him a little bit of decent coaching and some mentoring in his life, these kids love the game the same way that you and I did, you know, the same way that when we first started playing the game. And so, again, we don't think of kids in the inner city playing lacrosse, but for the same reasons that we love the game, these kids learn to love the game, and it's really neat. And so if we can use the game to help improve their lives a little bit, you know, it's kind of neat to see that happen.
Shifting the focus to, you know, this college lacrosse season, you know, just very generally, what's been your approach to following the action on the field?
It's been a little bit of a strange spring, to be honest. It's been hard to, I've watched a couple of games. I haven't seen Virginia play live. I've watched some of the highlights afterwards. And so I'm a little, you know, a little in touch with what's going on there. And I've stayed in touch with the coaches and some of the players and all, you know, but even just the college game, I've been around to a couple of games and all, and frankly, it's a little strange to be sitting in the stands. I was at the Loyola Hopkins game at Hopkins. David was good enough to leave me some tickets and this, and I took my wife and my girls, and I almost felt guilty sitting in the stands. You know, I feel like, geez, I should be out in the anguish, you know, in the ebb and the flow of what's going on in the field. You know, I'm sitting up here eating popcorn, watching the game and all, in some ways it's been a little bit of my relationship with the college game has been a little bit of a hands-off thing. And frankly, I've told people if I really had my druthers, we have a little house in the Adirondacks in upstate New York. I might just take a couple of good books and ride out the spring, up there. I've watched it a little bit and things like that, but it has certainly been a unique time in my life and probably a little bit peculiar, overall.
Well, I want to ask you about this because it was one of the things I was most fascinated by heading into this season. You know, I argued that the fact that Mark Van Arsdale landed as an assistant coach at Loyola was a perfect fit because of his familiarity with players who have skill sets similar to Patrick Spencer's. And I was able to watch Loyola live on Wednesday in an 11-10 win over Georgetown, in which Pat Spencer went for 2-5. And, you know, while his athletic profile might be different from a Steele Stanwyck or a Danny Gladding or a Matt Ward or a Connor Gill, there's so much about the way that he's able to control games that felt like it was native to Mark. And now that Loyola is 8 games into the season, you've had an opportunity to see this, and I know that you've kept in touch with Mark. What's your sense of how that relationship has grown and developed?
I just think that the fact that Spencer was there when, you know, as Mark was getting there is just a bonus for everybody involved. You know, certainly, you know, when I was listening to Charlie talk about, his most important recruit of the summer being Mark Van Arsdale, I understood that. You know, the opportunity to bring Mark on your staff, irregardless of who you happen to have on your team in any particular year, I think would be a priority for anybody, you know, to be able to have Mark come and work with you and stuff. The fact that, you know, Mark's worked with a lot of players with somewhat similar skill sets to Spencer's is just a bonus. I think for Charlie, you know, you're looking at somebody like Mark being able to challenge Spencer in a way, you know, that intellectually challenge him and then lacrosse wise challenge him. Spencer knowing that Mark has coached the likes of, you know, the Connor Gills and the Matt Wards and the Danny Gladdings and the Steele Stanwicks, you know, say what you will, it gives him a little legitimacy in the eyes of a player like that. You would say that it's a match made in heaven. You know, each of these players is a little bit different. Talking to Mark about Spencer, having watched him a little bit, you'd say he's a little bit, you might say he's a little bit more athletic than Steele. Maybe Steele's a little slicker. Steele was more athletic than people ever gave him credit for. So each of these players is a little different anyway. And Spencer is certainly in that caliber of being a really, really elite attackman at this level. And those guys are, you know, precious, few and far between. As a coach, these are the kind of young men that you love to work with. And I think Loyola was very fortunate that Mark was available and ready to come. I think for Mark, frankly, I think he landed in a good place. You know, again, irregardless of Spencer, Charlie's a good guy. Loyola's a place that cares about lacrosse. They've got good facilities. They're motivated and enthusiastic about what they're doing. And in the meantime, Mark gets to be there and serve as an influence on someone's play and someone's life like a Spencer and all. And so, good stuff on both sides and all around.
You mentioned you haven't had an opportunity or haven't seen Virginia play live, but I know that the connectivity and the phenomenon and the trends between Virginia and Brown and the way that they're impacting college lacrosse at large, both in terms of their tempo, and the way that I phrase it is Virginia leads the nation in stuff that happens during the game. There's so few dull moments, so few downtimes. And then obviously there's the perspective of you know, one of the things that you mentioned multiple times last spring was the importance of knowing that Zed Williams was going to be okay, and he's gone on to continue to fill up the score sheet while on the field playing attack for this Cavalier squad. So I'm curious as to those two things in terms of your reaction to the way in which this speed-based phenomenon has taken root at Virginia, as well as what your perspective is on the success that some of your former players have gone on to this season.
Well, I'm really happy for Zed, and the better part of that story is even the fact that he's so far ahead in his academic credits that he could take a lighter load this spring, and he's getting ready to graduate on time in May, and that's been a great, great story. One of the successes of one of the kids, I was at High Point this past week, and one of the boys asked me about the high points of my career, and I said it's easy to look at some of the championship teams and some of the teams that didn't win championships but had really good seasons, and I said that's the easy one, but it's also, somebody like Zed, who came to Virginia and, there was real uncertainty about whether or not this was the right fit and the right thing to do. And he deserves all the credit in the world for what he's been able to accomplish. I give Lars credit for using him on the attack. It's not to say that somebody else might not have thought to do that. But it seems like that's a move that has worked out for them. And that seems to be flourishing there. And so good for them. The whole phenomenon of this playing fast thing, and I'm not being critical here. Let's try to be that. What I'm going to try to be is a little bit analytical as much as anything else. It's been interesting, with Sean Kerwin, the assistant here at Virginia, who came with Lars from Brown, and with his background at Tufts, and to have Mike Daly be the new Brown coach and bring a complete staff of Tufts guys, and the most unbelievable statistic of the spring so far has been the post game stats in the Brown Stony Brook game. Is Brown and Stony Brook playing? Brown is highly rated in the early part of the season. They give up 66 shots. Stony Brook scores 25 goals. I look at this thing as it's interesting. I was always a big John Wooden fan, and I used to listen to him talk about, we don't do scouting reports. We don't worry about our opponents. We only worry about ourselves. And you would think to yourself, okay, well, that's fine and dandy when you have Lou Alcindor handing the ball to Sidney Wicks, who's handing the ball to Bill Walton over a period of about 10 years, and in Tufts' case, and this is while Sean Kerwin was there also, both as a player and as a coach. For the last 10 years, Tufts has been better than everybody they've played, until they get to the Division III finals. If you are better than the people you play, you can play any way you want, there's certainly an adjustment period going on here for what Virginia is trying to do and what Brown is trying to do this year. Last year, Brown arguably was the most talented team in the country, with nine All Americans, essentially the best goalie, the best faceoff guy, and the Tuaretan Award winner, on the same team. And so it's just been interesting to see, okay, can you do that in a schedule where you're playing 50-50, more 50-50 games, where you're not the favorite, the heavy favorite going into every game? And it's been very interesting to see both Brown and Virginia deal with that issue, in terms of whether or not we need to set some pace. I watched while I was at Coach Adele's, when I was at Dick's house on Saturday, we watched the Brown Harvard game, and I had watched Brown Villanova, 10 days before that. And I thought Brown struggled a little bit defensively in the Villanova game, but they looked much better organized, much better, just much better across the board against Harvard. And you feel like, okay, I think they've actually pulled it in a little bit, rather than thinking we have to make a play every minute, and if turnovers don't matter, it felt like they just played at a little bit more controlled tempo and played very well, beating Harvard on Saturday and all. And so this whole phenomenon of whether or not they can do this when they're involved in a lot of games in which they're 50-50. Like I said, the semifinal game last year, Brown and Maryland, and I give Brown a lot of credit, certainly give Dylan Malloy was a hero that day, but if you're making your living playing that game, can you be satisfied walking away with having turned the ball over 25 times? You lost a one-goal game, and so I think that's the self-examination that the coaches go through, and probably both of these programs are kind of coming to terms with that themselves. And I talked to Lars about this, actually. We've talked a lot over the years about setting the pace of, at the pace of games. When he first started, playing, when he brought the Kerwin kid on board and he started playing this way, can we do it, Dom? And I would say, look, it's got to be okay to value the ball, possession of the ball, once in a while. You're up two with 3 minutes to play, you don't have to heave the ball to a pole in the middle of the box, and so I just think they're trying to wrestle with making those decisions for themselves and deciding whether or not they need to temper the pace of things a little bit so that they can take a little bit better care of the ball. I mean, there's always been teams that have played fast. And I think, frankly, I could make an argument that the teams that have been most successful have been the teams that play fast. Syracuse, Virginia, Duke over the last 20 years in the game and all. But at the same time, there is something to managing a game to win the game. That's part of the science of what we do. And so it's not just about, we play breakneck speed all the time, what you want to be doing is we want to put our kids in a position where they can be successful. Playing fast makes a lot of sense. At the same time, there may be game situations in which we need to be a little bit smarter. So it'll be interesting to see in particular, because then I have a rooting interest for both teams, both Brown and Virginia. It's just be very interesting to watch these teams continue to develop over the course of the season. In both cases, you have new guys in the goal. Brown's got a freshman, and Virginia's been playing a freshman in the goal. And so, you think of that Brown-Stony Brook game. You got a freshman in the cage. Under any circumstance, do you really want to be giving up 66 shots with a puppy? You're going to change his life. Never mind how the game is going to go.
And so
you wind up, you wind up having to consider some of these things. And I think that's what's going on at both schools at this moment.
You mentioned the most interesting storyline or stat of the season so far being the Brown Stony Brook post game. For me, it's the way in which this perception has influenced other programs and the idea of being a leader in this space, and also the ability to take one truth and apply it over another truth and create correlation, that ipso facto post hoc prep rock thing. To me, the most interesting stat so far this season is that Maryland is 14th in pace and 8th, tied for 7th in scoring offense at 13 goals per game. This is a traditional Terrapin offense under John Tillman that has not pushed the tempo that much. That could very easily be caused by something that was referred to on an Inside Lacrosse podcast earlier this week, which is that, maybe Maryland for the first time in several years feels like it has to outscore teams. Christian Sweezy said that or posited or theorized that. But you also wonder whether or not they feel influenced by the way that their Brown and North Carolina games unfolded in the end of the 2016 season.
Well, I think a couple things here. One is that I believe firmly that you have to score to win. If you want to win big in lacrosse, you need to be able to score goals. And I'm all for the old adage of defense wins championships, but it's really defense and offense wins championships. And so teams that have tried to do it just by playing good defense and keeping the score down have generally not been successful. And like I mentioned earlier, referenced earlier about Virginia and Duke and Syracuse and the teams that are willing to go up and down and give their kids some responsibility, I think that that's very much of a factor. And the second thing is, Terry, I feel very strongly that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. And so, Brown may be trying to play really fast, or Virginia's trying to play really fast and all. We've done that in the past. And then you come back to, you know, does it suit our personnel? And you come back to, you know, playing sound lacrosse, you know, and so the future of our game is not necessarily, you know, playing the way that the way that Virginia wants to play, you know, everybody playing at breakneck pace. We don't all have those kind of players, you know? So you know, if you're going, what you're saying is Sienna, you know, who's 0-8 right now, is to say, hey, you need to take more shots, John. You need to run up and down the field and take every shot that shows. I don't think that's the answer either to a guy who's trying to get the most out of his team and trying to win a game. And so at the end of the day, it's about playing sound lacrosse. Now, Virginia, and I would make the argument that Maryland over the years, you know, which has almost always played at a little bit more deliberate pace than some of the other big boys, that Maryland should be playing faster. You know, that Maryland in the days when, in the 70s, when they, you know, when Urso and those guys were there, cripes, you know, they would knock you to the ground and then stomp out your life. And, you know, and so that was when they were, when they had their most success. You know, there's no reason why Maryland can't have the kind of athletes that allow them to get after you, you know, all over the field. So anyway, like I was suggesting, I think it's really, really interesting what Brown and Virginia have tried to do or what they've been doing. It'll be really interesting to see if it hasn't been, you know, related to what they're, you know, like I said, you know, in Tuff's case, again, they've just been the favorite in every game they've played in the last 10 years. So you can get after it all the time, you know, and in Brown's case last year, just better than everybody, you know, but now that they're, both teams are involved in more 50-50 games, whether or not they play, need to take a little bit better care of the ball and be a little bit more deliberate. And that's not retreating. That's simply being smart, making smart decisions. You know, it's not generally, you know, everybody doesn't play a zone. Everybody doesn't do this, doesn't do that. I don't think, you know, it's been neat to watch and fun to observe and analyze. I don't know that they're actually changing the world. But again, that also remains to be seen.
We're going to get you out of here with one more question, and I'm going to give you your choice based on some of the trends and some of the storylines of the early season of this 2017 calendar year. The first is an incredible freshman class that has been productive beyond pretty much any in recent memory in my historical perspective. The second is four undefeated teams, three coming from the Big Ten. And then the third is the impending NCAA vote on recruiting legislation. Which of those trends or storylines interests you the most?
Well, I probably, I know the freshmen at Brown because I know them well, and I've certainly watched those stats and stuff. I watched a little bit of the Ohio State Denver game the other day, and so I watched some of those Ohio State guys were flinging the ball around like they were an MLL team, you know, on an extra man in a settled offense and stuff. It was kind of neat to see that. I probably don't know enough of the names nationwide to be able to comment on that piece of it and all. I think the NCAA legislation piece that you bring up is, I've been talking to lots of folks about it. It's an important piece of business. I mean, if it passes, it's dramatic news. It would go against, you know, everything that the NCAA has been telling us for the last 10 years. You know, the college coaches get blamed a lot for the early recruiting, frankly, most of us would have liked to have been able to slow it down, is to put the brakes on it in years past. But with all the moving parts that are involved, we really needed the NCAA to step up and help us out with the whole thing. And now they've got a piece of legislation in front of them. They're going to vote on it in only a month's time that I think would make a real difference. It's actually a piece I wrote the original proposal. It was back in 2009, I think. And the NCAA said, look, we just don't want to. The college guys voted to support the very legislation that they're going to vote on next week, but the NCAA next month. But the NCAA said, we're not interested in talking about this right now. And but now with the men and women together coming together with the exact same proposal, you'd like to think that the NCAA will feel like we need to encourage this kind of cooperation. And, if it passes and there's no contact, none of this backdoor stuff and no contact allowed between a prospect and the college coaches before September 1st of their junior year, I think that would restore a little normalcy to people's lives, to parents and high school players and stuff. I think it would help get the high school coaches back involved in the recruiting process. So there's a lot of pluses here. And I think the only negatives from the NCAA are sort of administrative ones. And, and hopefully that they can appreciate how much this means to the world. And I think if this passes, then men's and women's lacrosse can really be proud of standing up in front of the world and saying that we're willing to take a stand on this and do something about it. And then I think you're going to see lots of other sports follow suit.
Well, Dom Starja, it's been too long since we've heard from you. We really appreciate, or at least your voice. We've obviously read you on InsideLacrosse.com and in the pages of the magazine. But we certainly hope that unless you decide to retreat to the Adirondacks, we can speak with you again once more before the season ends. And certainly we'll follow the growth and development of Harlem Lacrosse as you continue to contribute to that organization.
Terry, always good to catch up. And I want your job, by the way. So just let me know if that's available.
You got it.
So.
I think I know the guy to talk to about that one.
Okay.
Hashtag embrace the grind. We work for the fans. We work for the 71 Division I teams. Hashtag don't quit.